We're in the sixth month now on this series, Becoming a Mature Christian. And today we're going to consider a theme that is very relevant to each of our lives. And I'd like to illustrate that again. The theme is accepting ourselves as male or female, and doing so puts us in a position to develop a deep, loving relationship with God. When we consider growing spiritually, there's a real danger of not understanding ourselves and therefore not understanding the spiritual problems that each of us develops if we fail to see, say, the right place our bodies play in the spiritual life, and the increased danger of failing to appreciate our bodies as God made them. Let us say it, sexual bodies, male or female. If we are to a great extent unbalanced in our fear, say, of sex, there will be harmful psychological, physical effects unrecognized by us. They can make itself, or this can make itself felt in our spiritual life. For example, people who have an unreasonable fear of sex to the extent that they're afraid to even look at their bodies because it will remind them of something impure. God doesn't make impure. It's the bad intention because of original sin that individuals have. Such fear is not to be held up for imitation, and is not saintly. The virtues of chastity and continence are saintly, but extreme fear is not. False modesty does not come from God. I have a note here. I don't know how true it is, but long ago, how long ago, I don't know. But it's an it's a carryover from what we call Jansenism. Students were taught that they should bathe with a bathing suit because the angels were present. Our guarding angels are with us all the time. God indwells us all the time, no matter where we are. Now, that's due to bad teaching, and can also come from a lack of teaching of the right kind. It may also come from the spirit of evil, or from both. The spirit of evil may want to handicap us through some exaggerated fear of sex in order to destroy our spiritual life or cripple it. For example, scruples. That means to see sin where there is no sin. As, for example, when a person has spontaneous sex feelings, not due to any deliberate thoughts, and to think that just having them are a sin. That's simply what you call a human reaction that can come at any time, and therefore it's not a sin until a person wants it deliberately. To consider even unnecessary touches of the sex organs, as when bathing, or for medical reasons, as automatically sinful, a scrupulous person would be troubled that way. Now, Satan's ultimate reason for perhaps trying people this way may be to discourage them from striving for holiness. But this may be due also to ignorance. This kind of attitude toward sex may be due to spiritual pride, which makes a person see him or herself as advanced so far in spirituality that the flesh and anything to do with it has to be condemned. Now, that's a heresy. This kind of pride is a sign of what we call the angelic heresy, In other words, a person wishing that they didn't have a body, therefore wanting to be like an angel. What may happen here is that such pride becomes a breeding ground for temptation, as well as a foolish blindness to occasions of sin. In other words, they are brash enough to tread where normal persons would have a healthy fear of going, into open temptation, situations that could lead to real sins against chastity, or it may result in a certain kind of sexual insensibility that is taken wrongly for true spiritual progress, and in reality is psychological repression. In some of these persons, Satan may be after high stakes, because they have great spiritual potentialities. In other words, they could possibly be real saints and could lead many to God. They are souls who can love more than most people. In them, the sexual instinct is closely bound to the emotion of love, more so than in most people. This does not mean that there will always be a sexual response when the emotion of love for God is inflamed. But we need to know that the very act of surrendering ourselves to God in prayer has a psychological similarity and an unconscious connection with the sexual instinct. This surrender is different in man and in woman. Man gives himself to God by going out to him, because this going out is the basic way in which a man loves. Woman generally accepts love and surrenders to it. But these attitudes are not exclusive to their sex, as sexual beings or as spiritual beings. Psychologically, we are a combination of both. But we need to note that here, a great fear or a disgust for sex can extend itself in our unconscious mind to anything that has a similar likeness to sex. So the prayer response in a man or woman may become rigidly cold by unconscious inhibition. The same effect can be seen in relationships with our neighbor. Instead of a wholehearted but prudent love of our neighbor, we become cold persons or enslaved spirits, tortured by our unrecognized fear. It's true there can be other causes for this coldness, but it's quite true that if we try to extinguish or crush the sexual instinct consciously or unconsciously, we may at the same time extinguish the fire and warmth we are meant to give to God and to our brothers and sisters in Christ. The sexual instinct is a necessary part of all of us, more so in some than in others, and yet in a good sense. Sex is so much a normal part of us that it affects the whole person, and only extreme hunger, thirst, or danger to life are equal to it. Even normal sexual attraction involves a deeper and more far-reaching response within us than normal desires for food, because it involves the most powerful instincts of possession and surrender in the complete love and union that a person seeks. We cannot treat the sexual instinct in the same casual way that we treat, say, the instinct for food and drink. Now, we've talked about this instinct as a permeating power and is fundamentally a love nature, the only union in which it finds its lawful fulfillment and its perfection is the marriage union, in which a man and woman pledge each other love and devotion for life. The sexual act in marriage is intended to be a spiritual love action expressed in physical terms. This is the immediate end of the ideal marriage relationship, each giving to the other of themselves in pure, unashamed abandonment.
Although God intends by this act to bring into the world children for heaven as the ultimate end of this act, love is the ordinary immediate intention of the persons, their spirit and their bodies in this love embrace. While this act of love shows God's goodness towards us in giving us this kind of fulfillment, it also shows the danger to ourselves if we are not prepared to see its presence as an act of love, to see its full purpose and its beauty. We are too close to this need for the fullness implied in this instinct to disregard it. If we have a fear or dislike for sex, we will not be at home in our bodies. We will be pulled apart psychologically. We will find that the inner conflict will use up our energy uselessly, and when it's unresolved, will leave us constantly tired without our knowing the reason. In the spiritual life, this failure to appreciate our sexual nature is not a minor thing. Finding our true selves means also finding ourselves as male or female. We must accept our bodies and the bodies of the opposite sex precisely for what they are. If we do not have respect for it, our manhood, womanhood, will suffer. Our bodies, with what makes them male or female, are ourselves along with our souls. If we do not love and respect these bodies as male or female, our respect for our particular selves will be destroyed. If we destroy our nature in trying to wipe out our masculinity or femininity, we're giving God's grace a very hard job to do. That's an important thought. It should be clear that we are not urging people to forget the danger here or to seek complete freedom of expression, but only an appreciation and an honor for the gift as God designed it and intends its use. We hate sin, sinful tendencies, but we love what God has made. It's easy to see all this in its ideal and theory, but not so in practice. At the stage of the spiritual life that we're talking about here in this series, in other words, those who are beyond the beginner stage in their spiritual growth, we're leaving out the question of sin, because persons like that do not normally have problems with serious sins against chastity. I mean people advanced in the spiritual life. But those who are at this stage can become too involved in the deep attraction which flows from the sexual instinct than it merits. Both those who are married and the unmarried can become too forgetful of the beauty and the evidence of the spiritual. For example, such a person in this stage of the spiritual life can form judgments about others and their conduct which are based more upon their physical charm rather than their spiritual qualities, their virtues. So a man may notice only the physical charm of a woman and overlook her virtues and good spiritual qualities. Then, too, a person like that can be insensitive to the presence of Christ in a person who does not attract them physically or emotionally. Take Mother Teresa of Calcutta. Is she a USA beauty? But she's a worldwide spiritual beauty. One can be too attached to physical charm and beauty and easily give in to disgust for the physical defects of others instead of loving a person for their true spiritual worth as precious to the heart of Christ and temples of God. Now, this does not mean we must be blind to all appreciation of physical beauty, but rather we must control it and our enjoyment of it so that it doesn't stifle our appreciation of higher spiritual value, say, in another person, or our freedom of soul. Now let's look at, say, the sexuality of a person of their spiritual life, their married life. True appreciation of the sexual instinct has been at times too limited to the saying that marriage is a remedy for the rebellious sexual instinct since the fall. This is true, but not the full truth, and it does not apply to a spiritual person seeking a deep union with God, but has a mistaken notion of self-denial. They too, insofar as they have entered marriage, should use this remedy of alleviating the sexual instinct and its demands, but they should use the full, wonderful plan of God in giving this instinct to us as the ideal to which man and woman should aim in its exercise. The sexual instinct carries a man and woman out of themselves and into the intense relationship with each other. The fact of being alone is overcome. Two human beings are for a time one in body, and in this union of their bodies, they are more permanently one in their spirit, their soul. Besides bringing fulfillment to man and woman in the sublime creation of new life that carries the imprint of themselves and their children, there is also fulfillment in the giving, receiving of love for the person through the sexual union and in its accompanying expressions of affection. The practical results of the sexual union and the pleasure that follows also has a good effect on their spiritual life, because for the married, sexual intercourse is a source of grace. The pleasure involved can be a great support in the difficulties both of life and of personality. To mistakenly deny themselves the pleasure on the part of one or the other, while merely cooperating in the act of love externally, would put that person outside of the providence of God, who intends them to enjoy it. But it will also be an injustice to the partner, and a slow cooling off of spontaneous love. Whereas through the enjoyment of this physical pleasure, discouragement, aimlessness, personal insecurity can be removed in the love that is given and received. Now, this must be said for a complete insight into married life, namely, married people must not stress sexual fulfillment to the point where it starves the spiritual life, as if it were the supreme aim of their life. In all this, the spirit must prevail. The sexual life must lead to greater spiritual life and growth. The fruits of the spirit, which are greater than sex, are found in these words of St. Paul, and I'm quoting from Ephesians. This is Galatians first. The fruit of the spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, generosity, faith, mildness, chastity. Now, of course, we're presenting sexual life for the married as the ideal picture, the way God designed it for them. In practice, and for many reasons, the ideal is not always attained because one or the other partner is not open to that ideal, or they are too sensual. It's then that the sexual life can become an added burden. Even when there is no fault in one of the partners, there is a burden, as St. Paul points out in Corinthians 1 Corinthians 7:28. Should you marry, you will not be committing sin, but such people will have trials in their life, and these I should like to spare you. The total life of the married is not limited to the marriage act, but also includes the fulfillment of the duties of love toward spouse and children. God intends that the sexual relationship in marriage, when body and spirit are united in the one act of love, should be a means of increasing grace and not an obstacle to grace. We need to see that we grow in grace not only by self-denial, but also by doing pleasurable things taken with the right intention and moderation. And that includes food, sleep, recreation, and it applies to sexual fulfillment for the married. Now, the dangers. There are inbuilt dangers in the sexual instinct, and not only the obvious ones like sexual abuse, but also the spirit can be blinded to the need for a deeper spiritual life by too much preoccupation with sex. To make sex an end in itself always results in a deep emptiness. And even when this instinct is brought into control in God's plan, its attraction can be so delightful that there is no great desire to go to God or become a more interior or recollected person. So married persons should be on their guard against the tendency of sex to over-attract them. Neither the sexual instinct nor its essential attractiveness is the result of original sin. That's what God intended. But the strong pull toward the purely physical side of sex, or toward the sexual experience as something to be enjoyed only in itself, is a disharmony resulting from the fall of man. St. Thomas clearly teaches that the great pleasure of sex is not an evil effect, even though in the sexual ecstasy a man and woman experience are beyond self-possession of reason. He says, "For reason itself demands that the use of reason be interrupted at times, for example, in sleep. But the danger of our spiritual life, or to our spiritual life, is in the tendency of the physical to dominate the sexual experience, or a more subtle danger, in the tendency of the love experience to make itself the sole end. Regarding the excessive pull toward the physical side of sex, this must be balanced by seeing the situation in the light of love and beauty. Tenderness, consideration of the partner, are important in bringing this about. Love of neighbor as oneself will prevent sexual expression from becoming an expression of selfishness rather than human fulfillment." This is the great value of externalization of love and tenderness. Namely, their purpose is to express, symbolize love for the other person. If married persons are to grow greatly in grace, a further compensation for the great attraction of physical sexual love must be made. We do not mean that husband or wife must deny themselves the pleasure, or through a false idea of the virtue of chastity or modesty, they should become reserved in a supreme joy of giving, receiving the joys of sexual love. The compensation we're talking about is that God be brought into the situation, at least in the intention, before lovemaking and in thanksgiving after lovemaking, that the things be done in his sight, that the ecstasy of sexual love be further deepened by offering the Lord the love for this beloved person in this intimate manner, and that the surrender of self to the other be done in him. Are those persons outside of God when they love each other? No way. If you're in the state of grace, God is present. One person said that they had a mistaken notion about God being present. So when they made love, they turned the picture of the Lord to the wall. Now, with the right attitude, in this way, the human spirit rises to God, and as a result of this love experience, God's goodness is discovered in depths that are very profound, and love for so good a God increases in proportion. And I've had persons share it in the 14 times that I've given a charismatic encounter retreat for married people, who have told me that they praise God in that supreme moment. They just bless God and praise him. Well, that's what it should be. See, God's love is not excluded. That kind of love is a fraction of God's own love. Now, that's seeing it as it is. And some have shared with me that they had some doubts about, in other words, God's presence, and what should they do? And I simply said, God intended you to have this, enjoy this in God's presence. Bless him for it. Now, what about sexuality in those who live a single life or the unmarried? It includes all who must live without sexual satisfaction that is fully deliberately sought beyond God's commandments and plan. This includes all who are in this state in spite of their own choice, but are called to this state by God's providence, like circumstances of their life, the difficulty of finding a marriage partner, or because of some accident of life. A person that's a paraplegic, for example. But we speak particularly to those who are dedicated unmarried, whether they are in religious life or live as lay Catholics. They've made an offering of the lawful sexual life open to them in marriage. This is a great offering and is often considered heroic, but it's not always so considered. Instead, it's something said, sometimes said, that by the celibate life we become frustrated men and women, only half a human being. That opinion shows a lack of understanding of the term frustration in its psychological meaning. The author from whom I'm drawing my material, as Father Dominic Hoffman, said, frustration never occurs when a higher part of our nature is able to impose itself reasonably upon another part of our nature. For example, even though we may be hungry, we may wait for the food to be served. We're not emotionally frustrated just because we don't go out and gobble up the food in the kitchen. The heroic, when it is wholeheartedly embraced, does not frustrate us, but it ennobles us. The beauty of sexual love and its desirability, while meant for the married, is still not a fruitless consideration for the dedicated unmarried. First, they must not think that they are so superior to sex that they will despise sexual love. They too were made for this by nature, according to the design of God. A religious, whether man or woman, does not cease to be a man or woman. They are that first before their vocation. They should see their sexuality as a blessed part of their human nature, and their offering of it as a gift from God because of this choice of them. On the other hand, their appreciation of their sexuality will not be expressed in an envious thirst for what they have given up, nor in fruitless, hopeless longings, yearnings, rather in gratitude that God has given so great a gift to humanity, while not forgetting that He has given a greater gift to them. Their appreciation of what they have freely given to God will result in a greater dedication to God in their vocation, provided this appreciation is kept within reasonable bounds. Through this knowledge and appreciation of their own sexuality, they will be closer to God than if they were to look at the sexual relationship as grossly repugnant in an effort to dull its attraction. This does not mean that they will not experience inner conflict and emptiness at least at times, and that their sexual nature will make demands, but there will be a sustaining gratitude for being chosen by God to come to Him directly, rather than through the support and privileges of married love and companionship. The central fact in all this, both for the married and unmarried, both cannot live without love. Love is necessary for our full development. Again, I'm quoting Father Dominic Hoffman. We need to be carried out of ourselves and into the spiritual being of another. Marriage accomplishes this for the vast majority, but many others find this in true friendship. But no human being is able to fill us completely. There is a deeper love needed to do this, the love of God, who is love, who made love, and who made us to love Him. Unquote. While human love can never fulfill us completely, this love of the Lord never grows faint, but always grows stronger, more intense, even in hidden ways as we become more and more like the Beloved Himself, the Lord. To experience God's love for us is the greatest experience we can have in this life. And this love can grow to the point where it can burst the web of our life and release our spirit forever in the everlasting embrace of the Divine Beloved, as it did say in the case of St. Teresa Little Flower. Her last words were, "In the end, only love counts. My God, I love you." Well, so much for our first conference. I hope that meant something to you. A lot of people, in my own experience in counseling, have told me on the charismatic encounter, anybody here made that retreat with me? I gave it over in the Sisters of St. John the Baptist on the near Glencove. Morgan's Island. Yes. All right. Well, they've told me that they've never heard a better appreciation of what married love is about. In other words, there's not to be any fear to begin with. And the ideal is that it's a sharing of God's love, and that in loving one another, they are gracing one another, and it's holy. All right, any questions? I want to also comment on what you're saying. If our parents have had not the right attitude, then of course, as you just said, they pass it on to the children. And I'm even meeting married people today, a woman who said, "I only do it to have children, and I wouldn't allow my husband to come near me." Now, that's a very sad state. A very sad state. There's terrible ignorance there, and I only hope that it's due to ignorance, because it's a state of sin. It's a serious obligation. And I wonder, in other words, what preparation they've had. This is another reason for why they need six, what they call conferences, before marriage and engagement. And it helps to clear a lot of mistaken notions that people have, either because of what others told them or what they don't know, and what they have, we call them preconceived notions, that have to be dispelled. Otherwise, it's going to be a very unhappy marriage. You were going to say something. See, they, and also too, there's a false modesty. I have to be frank, in a sense, that you can't reveal yourself. You have to be clothed. Well, God made the body to be beautiful, and marriage is a complete giving. So there's no need, or there's no time for what we call false modesty, even in a hospital. There's no modesty in the hospital, in a sense. There isn't any part of you that isn't under observation, I can tell you personally. But I want to finish this. I was told even recently that even a husband is afraid to bear all, as they say, and his wife never sees him that way. And so again, it's a mistaken notion, and it's part of what you call self-revelation and a full acceptance of one another. And it's beautiful too, though, when, for example, she's had a mastectomy, then she feels, you know, well, mutilated, and that he won't love her anymore. And it's great when he applies a medication to that area of her, showing tenderness and acceptance and so forth. All this comes into, you know, that kind of love that is a complete acceptance of who we are. And, well, some part of us is missing. And it helps to helps that person to accept themselves then. That's important. Yes?
No, you know what? I grew up with very strict religion and the nuns. And my parents never, none of my relatives ever heard anything of the way it's going on today, sex, right? So, I was taught very strictly, you don't show your body to nobody. You know, that is the sin, purity, and it's a sin to be immodest, even in your dress. I'm telling you, I dressed like the 1492s when I was a kid, because I feared anything. With no explanation, this is how it was for me. And then how I met my husband, you know, God made me leave my own country, Baltimore, Maryland, and brought me over here like Abraham. Well, to me, I'm in another country. I feel like I'm Abraham and Moses and all, taken out of their own hometown, and you're brought in a place you don't even know, just because your father opened up a business up here, and you still didn't know the score, right? And I met my husband, and I didn't have a chance to really know the world. I really didn't. And, you know, it's out of a convent, and here we are being holy holies, and I wouldn't be near no guy ever, because we were separated. We were from the boys and the girls. It was, school was entirely separation, you know? really. And if you were caught even touching a guy, you got a beating from the nuns with their rulers, you know? And I didn't know what the score was. I didn't understand it. I didn't. And then comes my husband, and he had to put up with me. And how he had, I mean it. I really mean it. Because if I didn't meet him, well, they did try to make me become a nun, and I didn't know, you know, I didn't want to be in anymore. I wanted to be out, because every time I went home, I had a good time with the kids on the block and, you know, jump rope in the street and what have you. And then to go back to school and then stay there with the nuns and priests who just made me pray and cook and... that's why I'm a good cook. Because that was my life. Pray I was contemplative.
She's a holy cook.
I was contemplative before I was charismatic. Then when I heard of this blowout that I had through a serious illness, that's when I began to really realize, you know, hey, you know, I had it all the while, and here I am exploding and don't know what it is except God. And then it was my daughter who told me of the Holy Spirit, and I felt I had that way back and didn't absorb it, you know, and I enjoyed it. But today I love that life more than I ever loved, you know, being free. I'm free in the Lord, and I know it spiritually. I know everything I went through and why. It was his arms just holding me back from any forces of evil, I would say. But now, you see on television, I get so angry when I hear Masters and Johnsons and talking about foreplay, you know, with these lovemaking people. I think it's terrible, the teachings that are on TV. Now, I'm glad that I was brought up not knowing the other side of life except just, you know, contemplative and the prayer life, because that is what we're about. We're supposed to be listening to the Lord, our lives, but enjoy what he has made. And it's through the scriptures that I find everything. You want to read the scriptures. I can't believe what's even in the scriptures on those beginners of the,
yes.
The harlots.
Thank you, Mary. Yeah, the words are all there. I mean, again, it depends on your outlook, you see. All the words for sexuality are there, but in the right context, you know. What's wrong with circumcision? God used that as a form of baptism for the early Jewish law. And then the words for sexual intercourse are used. He went into her. Very primitive in a sense, but it's a descriptive definition. And then, of course, the different sins of man, they're all there. And but they're put the way it is before God, in other words. The sins are a sin. They're not overlooked, or nor are they like today, homosexuality and lesbianism and all that. Look how it's paraded. You can see the degradation of society. We're supposed to be a Christian world. How far are we from that? Yes?
I was just saying, it's not balanced. Like, before it was all, you know, like, in. Everything was,
Frustration,
and now it's completely gone the other way, whereas it should be. Is that what
they mean by holiness?
You know, yes. Balance,
where
it's all.
Right.
And that's holiness.
See, that's what this series is supposed to be doing.
Holiness is fullness. So if you're actually really balanced, then you have holiness.
Right.
Right?
See, it's in one way or another, they were stressing the body too much. That's what we're doing today. See? And then at, about a century ago, they were stressing the spirit too much at the expense of the body. Body was evil. They have to suppress all these instincts. And that's the reason why, and even I believe maybe St. Augustine may be accused of that, who said that intercourse is only intended to have children. Now, that passed on, and look, it's even last year, I had to inform somebody about that, who was denying her husband because she said, I have children now, and that's it. She's, in other words, enforcing a celibate life for him, which is a serious sin. But I believe it's only through ignorance that God is considering that mercifully.
Yeah, I'm reading a book now, and it talks about how you achieve wholeness, and they say the qualities are solitude and silence. And these things, people who have achieved this, they spend, you know, a certain amount of time